The River Signal, Episode 3, The Farm.
Long dash following 10 seconds of silence. 5 days in the sky,
the darkest. An original radio story written and recorded on the Channel Princess as it travels down the Mississippi. The River Signal features music and voices recorded on the bow of the paddle wheel riverboat.
Well now, that was a sweet little number. Thanks for tuning in. This is your weekly almanac. I'm Uncle Steven, and for the next hour, I'll be bringing you the weather and everything you need to know to weather the weather. That last one was called Razor Fern Number 4. I wrote it about 3 years ago, before I moved into the silo and beefed up my equipment. I can't say the song's real effect, agrosonically speaking, but I sure do like the sound of it. Anyways, let's talk weather. Today is the last day of the alligator moon, so watch out for low-hanging sunspots. You can expect light showers until afternoon, then foggy on through Thursday. With this moisture, you can bet the mango slugs will be everywhere, nibbling on your durian, your kale, your toes. As for razor ferns and suction vines, they're holding steady at about 15 feet tall. But the swarmers, oh, they got real bad yesterday. I got no idea why, and I'd welcome calls from anyone who does, because I've been throwing all sorts of stuff at them. 8-bit sawtooth, resonator synthesizers, 4-cycle drum machines, but I'm not sure any of it's working. Whenever I turn away or turn down the volume, they're back, swarming my silo, buzzing over the crops and wilting the leaves. I'm starting to think I need to dig into the cache, pull out some of those tapes I'd swore I'd never play again. I hope it doesn't come to that, but just in case, maybe keep some weapon-grade earplugs handy.
I gotta say, I'm feeling a bit let down by the signal. I'd been expecting all kinds of juicy stories, maybe some excerpts from tugboat unionist meetings or riverfolk riddles, but everybody's just talking traffic, motors, and weather. I didn't have to leave Superior Land to hear that. This really is a sweet little boat. All morning I've been sitting on the top deck, watching the paddle wheels spit froth and listening to the purr of the engine. Once we installed that plasma damper, it fired right up. If I had my way, we'd be giving this thing a proper christening, drinking something brown and sweet, opening the throttle, hydroplaning straight down to the Mississippi. Instead, we're just trolling through some soupy, weed-choked backwater. It's safer this way, says Huckins. He's probably right. It is smart to stick to this side channel, far clear of the cove where that mega wave swallowed Pixley. That thing just came out of nowhere. And that sound, it almost seemed like it was riding atop the wave, or inside it. Anyway, I've got no interest in getting near that again, and I believe Huckins when he says he doesn't either. Still, I feel like he's hiding something. Because just now, while the three of us were listening to the signal, that guy came on with his weirdo weather banter. Uncle Steve was his name, I think. Anyway, Huckins perked right up. Like, I actually think I saw his ears move. He was listening so hard. For the whole song, he kept his head right by the speaker, and he kept turning up the volume, even though it kind of just sounded like beeps and boops to me. When it was over, he stood and blinked back any trace of emotion. He's got the same look now. I can see him down there in the wheelhouse, wearing that terrible poker face as he pushes us further and further into the murk. What are we even doing out here? We keep getting caught on sandbars, the props all gunked with ratweed, and everywhere I look, it's big, dumb, ugly plants. Rows and rows of them, all the same. Which, now that I think about it, I wonder if we're even on the Crow Wing anymore. The banks are too neat, too clean. This feels less like a river than one of those Superior Land canals that pumped lake water up into the Havens. Irrigation canals, they call them. But who even knows what that means anymore? I can't say I'd even noticed the skeeters before today, but they're getting pretty bad. Actually, I'm not quite sure they're skeeters. Sure, they buzz and bite, but they're weirdly fast. Matter of fact, I don't think I've even seen one yet, much less slapped it. Over on the starboard gunwale, Reed's giving his bare legs these lazy slow-mo swats, like he doesn't really care if he gets bit. Maybe that's the case, but probably he's just like me. Grew up in the woods, prides himself on being the kind of guy who isn't bothered by bugs. What was that? Way bigger than a skeeter, a bee, or any other bug I've seen. Closer to a bat, or maybe even a flying chipmunk. I think it was trying to get inside my ear. I look to the south where that thing came from and I see this shape-shifting, low-hanging cloud. It takes me a second to realize it's a swarm of bugs. Huckins must see them too because now he hits the gas, tries to outrun them, but they're way too fast. They get to Reed first. The bugs are enormous and hideous, like a cross between a locust and a wolf spider, and they seem to only be going for his ears. It looks like he's wearing a pair of giant, writhing headphones. Now they're on me, attacking my ears. It's almost like they're trying to take that terrible sound and stuff it inside me. I tuck into a ball, pull my flannel over my head. The skeeters take the opportunity to chomp the skin of my back, but those big swarmers, they're still trying to burrow through the wool, which they might not even need to, because if this keeps up much longer, that howl is going to explode my eardrums. I open my eyes. The swarmers are flying north in one uniform cloud, like a retreating army. And the little guys are gone too. Just like that. Huckins has stepped onto the deck. He's chewing on his lip and staring at shore. In a clearing between rows of identical plants, I see what looks like a loudspeaker.
The first time I heard these strange tones, I was a kid. It was Uncle Steve who showed me my first analog, and I've been tinkering ever since. He always had a handle on those old synthesizers. Man, I never met anyone else who could run them that hard. It'll be so good to see him. I hope he'll be able to tell me something about my folks, and I hope the guys won't mind the detour. I beach the boat in the mud and watch as Reed and the envoy lash lines around the wooden pole supporting the loudspeaker. I step behind the speaker and notice a clump of wire sneaking along a path that leads up from the river. The plants along the path's edge are leaning away like they've been blown back. Now the path breaks into a sort of clearing. This is Steve's farm, all right. Sun-bleached barns, skyscraping silos, rows and rows and rows of plants covered in clear tarps. I wonder how long it's been since I last saw him. I wonder if he'll even recognize me. The envoy points to the far edge of the clearing. There are speakers at narrow intervals, aimed out towards a wall of enormous ferns. And the wires from every speaker head towards a huge rust-scabbed silo that might have once been gray. We reach the silo door and I'm about to knock, but then I hear his voice.
Well, that about does it. I find that those 70 megahertz square waves are just the thing for the Beatles. And if any of my stuff did something good, bad, or ugly to your plants, let me know. I still got a lot to learn about agrisonics. And if those swarmers come for you and your crop...
I hesitate for a few seconds. It's been so long and I want to get my face right and my words right before it...
Well, look at that. The prodigal nephew.
We spend 3 days at Uncle Steve's. I've always sort of fancied myself a farmer, so right away I asked Steve how I can help. In no time, he's got me serving up fermented feed to spotted cattle, restocking the granary, and uprooting a slew of weeds. It's been some time since I dug in the dirt, and a healthy dose of sunshine and country air soothes my spirit. Plus, Uncle Steve gave me some pest-fell butternut in exchange for my labor. I think I'll use it to build a new banjo. It's a good thing I'm working, because no one else seems to be. Huckins and Steve have been inseparable, spending all their time looking through photo albums, walking the property, and having long talks in the farmhouse. And the envoy has been doing what the envoy does, snooping. Every time I see him, he's rummaging through piles of barnwood, crawling up the cellar, or trying to pick the locks in the big red barn, the one Steve refuses to even talk about. Now I'm sitting atop the carcass of a tractor, resting my joints after another satisfying day of dirt work, when I see Steve stalking the farm's perimeter. He's adjusting the speakers, arranging the wires. I watch a while and I call out and I jog over and ask him if he might tell me what those speakers are for. He's a quiet, unassuming fellow, so it's no surprise when he says nothing, just heads for the silo and motions for me to follow. I step through the hatch door, and when my eyes adjust, I see that we're in a giant sound lab. The entire ground floor is taken up by a mixing board, wrapping 360 degrees around us. It's a preposterously complex array of knobs, buttons, flashing screens. The walls just above us are mounted with countless reels of tape, each bearing a neat handwritten label. Most of the tapes are whirling on their wheels, so I can't quite read the words, but just above me I see one that says, Bartok Backwards Bananas, and another called Suction Vine Version 6. I'm about to ask what that all means when a voice behind me says, What are those? It's the envoy. He snuck into the silo and he's pointing out a gangway up top, where the walls are lined with a myriad of large glass jars. Steve nods and smiles at his feet, like he knew the envoy was going to ask this. Like maybe already has a couple dozen times. With a sigh, he walks over to the base of the ladder, and we go to follow him, but he waves a hand and tells us to wait down here. It takes Steve about 5 minutes to climb and descend the steps. Those jars are way up there. Just before he makes it back to ground level, Huckins comes walking in. Now Steve sets a bucket full of jars down before us. He pulls out the biggest one and hands it to me. When I see what's inside, I nearly drop it. It's that same sort of bug that attacked us back in the canals. Bulbous and black and bigger than any cicadas I've seen. And it's got at least a dozen of these weird shaped antennas. It's buzzing madly, banging against the glass. Call them sonically modified organisms, Steve says. He takes the jar from my hands and sets it back on the table. He says he doesn't quite know who's modified them or how or why. He only knows that they're the worst kind of pest and he's spent his whole life fighting them. Now he turns to the soundboard and says, Watch this. As the music plays, the bug in the jar begins to writhe. It then curls into a tight ball. Soon, it's motionless. Steve stands and leans back against the soundboard. Smiling, he says, Paralysis by pitch. As Steve returns the jar to the bin, he mutters something I can't quite make out. When I ask him to repeat it, he hesitates and says he's heard these things are all over the Mississippi. This seems odd. By my calculations, we can't be more than a few miles from the Mississippi. Steve must be reading my face because now he explains that he hasn't been to the Big River in years. Says it's nearly impossible to access through the irrigation canals. I tell him I'd like to hear a bit more about Nearly. Steve looks down at the jar. The buggy paralyzed is starting to wiggle its legs. Its dish antenna are probing the glass. Man, those things recover fast. With the bin tucked under his elbow, Steve starts up the ladder. When he makes it to the third level, he stops and leans over the rail. After a long pause, he says, "I think I know a way."
It's pretty nice out here. The sun's low, the bugs all but gone, the air a sweet mix of ripe bananas and old manure. But I'm antsy. I've been sitting on these hay bales for an hour now, writing a bit, but mainly just staring at that big red barn. I really want to get into that thing. I keep asking Steve, but every time I do, he doesn't even respond, just shrugs. The doors have got real strong padlocks too, so there goes plan B. And I'm not quite dumb enough to try scaling the wall and shimmying down through that hole in the roof. Now here come Uncle Steve and Reed and Huckins, heading out of the farmhouse, chatting up a storm. He's probably taking them out to the banana groves for another agrosonics lecture. And look, don't get me wrong, that stuff's real interesting, but I guess I'm just ready for... Wait. It looks like Steve's pulling a big key ring from his pocket. He's stopping at the barn. I get there just as they're stepping inside. The first thing I notice is the smell. It's musty and sweet, kind of like that old library I used to break into back home. Steve flips on the lights and I see the place is full of cassette tapes. Thousands of them, probably. There are shelves and shelves of them on every wall, reaching all the way up to the cobwebbed rafters. Before I can ask Steve what all this is for, he sets off across the barn, his eyes on the shelves. As he walks, he keeps stopping, fingering the tapes, and whispering to himself. I look to Huckins, but he just shrugs. He's confused too. Finally, when Steve's walked pretty much the whole way around the barn, he snaps his fingers, pulls out a tape, and heads back our way. Steve sticks the tape into a little stereo perched atop a pile of barnwood. He looks up at Huckins, his face suddenly serious. "He's sorry," he says, "for not playing the tape right away." Steve stops the tape and flips it over, muttering, "I know it's on here somewhere." At first, it's just empty tape. But when the voices start in, Steve and Huckins look at each other, then back down at the stereo.
"Horizon is just blue light and smoke. I've been watching the solar stones and the zinnia trees, and I can tell you that if it weren't for the roots and the laws of gravity, they'd take off and flutter away on their little root bundles. Wouldn't you say?"
"I would."
"It's that sound that's doing it. And if you heard it, you don't need reminding."
"No, you don't. We've been on the move now for 3 weeks, dodging the militias, the herbivores, and the stray wolfhounds. We lost a wagon wheel around Framingham, but we managed to tack something together. We're working on something big now. We've got a plan. We're heading to the Gulf, down where we won't be followed."
"Oh, you hear that?"
"What? What?"
"I think we better go. There's something moving on the far bank. I don't know if we got enough battery power for more broadcasts, so if you're listening out there, meet us down in the Delta. There's work to be done."
For some time, I just stare at the rolling tape. That was them. My parents. They sounded just like their old goofball selves, at least until the end. I'm about to ask Steve when he recorded this and how when I'm interrupted by an awful noise.
Shh.
Steve, who usually moves at the speed of syrup, now sprints across the silo and shoulders open the door. I trail behind him and follow his gaze. Those ferns and vines on the north edge of the fields, they're bobbing around like seaweed and sprouting shoots down into the crop beds. And above them, there's a pitch-dark, quivering cloud, an army of bugs coming down from the sky. Steve takes off running across the field towards his silo sound lab. I chase after, barely keeping up. He's pretty fast for an old farmer. I look over my shoulder to check on Reed and the envoy, and they're right behind me. But so is that enormous bug cloud. We make it to the silo just before they close in on us, and I dive inside, swing the huge, unoiled door shut. Those bugs are everywhere, splattering against the silo. These ones must be even bigger than the others. Some of them are hitting hard enough to dimple the steel. Steve's already sitting on a rain barrel, flipping dozens of dials and switches at the mixing board. I'm not sure what he's whipping up, but I hope he does it soon. These bugs are hitting harder and harder, and that weird wind is coming back. Now Steve flips a big yellow switch and says, "This here's a new recipe. You might want to cover your ears." When the song starts, I'm instantly transported back to my old house, to the little carpeted bay window in the den. I used to sit there while Mom sewed, and she always played Steve's stuff. Maybe even this exact song. It dawns on me that maybe this isn't the best time to get all nostalgic. Uncle Steve stands up from the mixing board. He pulls a key from his ring and puts it in my hand. He says, "I think you boys ought to go." I start to say we can't just leave, not now. But he shakes his head and says not to worry. He can handle the pests, always has. Steve opens a hatch opposite the main door. It leads to a shed containing a huge red tractor. He puts a bullhorn in my hand, it's playing his synth Onslaught incredibly loud, and tells us to take it to the tractor and head for the river as fast as we can. The envoy, who apparently has a thing for heavy machinery, snatches the keys and jumps through the hatch, but his left foot catches on the door jamb and he goes down sprawling onto the shed's straw-covered floor. His knee does something knees definitely aren't supposed to do. He's hurt, but there's no time to deal with it now. So I throw one of his arms over my shoulder and haul him onto the tractor. Reed takes the keys and hops into the driver's seat. I feel a hand on my shoulder. It's Uncle Steve. He's smiling and holding up a crinkled old map. "Take this," he says. "It'll get you where you need to go." And before I can get all sentimental, before I can give him a hug or even a handshake, he winks and shuts the hatch. We shoot out the shed doors, surprisingly fast. Steve must have worked his magic on this tractor. The envoy is lying on the engine cover, making that face you make when you don't want people to know you're in pain. I hop up and I stand beside him, and as Reed speeds us across the field, I hoist the loudspeaker high overhead. The sky is still full of bugs, and although they swirl around us, they never get within half a dozen feet. Whatever this music is, it's working. The footpath to the river is barely wide enough for the tractor. The bugs are thick here, and the razor ferns and suction vines are reaching in. I spin around with a loudspeaker, trying to fight everything at once. The envoy, still on his back, waves his arms around, which pretty much has zero effect. But hey, at least he's trying. When we hit the water, I stay on the tractor, holding the speaker against the flies, while Reed and the hobbling envoy untie the lines. As I backpedal down to the river and onto the boat, I notice that the bug cloud is thinning a bit, and that howl is maybe starting to fade, but I'm still relieved when I hear the engine fire up. Reed reverses the boat from the bank, spins us around, and pushes the throttle hard. The envoy and I join him in the cabin, and as he pushes the boat through high grass and cattails away from the farm, we press our faces to the stern windows. The bugs have all but disappeared. That awful howl, too. It's perfectly still out there now. I wonder what that silence means. I wonder what happened to Steve. Soon, the irrigation canals give way to a series of small, tree-rimmed lakes. Reed shuts off the motor, and for some time, we float in silence. The Mississippi's out there, somewhere beyond those trees. And hopefully, my parents are too.
Well, that's the last reel of that one. I've got a few tasty subsonic oscillators coming up for you. I grew up on these tones, and I can tell you, they're the best you'll find. They were enough to beat back the swarmers this time. But every day out here, we're losing ground. There's just too many of them, and there's not enough decibels to go around. One day, this farm will be a wasteland of mangled vines and rusting combines. Makes a guy really consider the important things, like self-awareness and family and toast. So I'm sending this one out to my nephew. I hope he finds what he's looking for down south. Maybe these old Wurlitzer drones can help clear his way. Stay out of big trouble in confined spaces, and don't pet the animals. And oh, if you get yourself in a spot, put out a call on the river signal. One of us weirdos will hear it. Promise.
This episode of The River Signal was written and recorded by Galen Huckins, Brian Benson, and Reed Lustig. Audio editing by Joel Schupak. Special thanks to Monica Baker, Dan Benson, Brian Huckins, Kathy Huckins, Fred Kerber, Gary Kerber, Barb Kelzer, Clarence Kelzer, Dorothy Kelzer, Diane Kelzer, Steve Kelzer, Peter, Ramon, Kevin Seif, Pam Sorrells, Ron Spurgeon, Jason Tansman, Shannon Woodward, 212 Medical Center, Ear Trumpet Labs, and KBOO 90.7. For pictures and video of the riverboat trip and a full session featuring the music of Steve Kelzer, check out riversignal.com. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week for episode 4.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. This has been The River Signal. Coming up next, it is the Riverboat Sessions, followed at 8 p.m. by A Different Nature. At 10 p.m., Talking Earth, and at 11 p.m., it's Gremlin Time. Stay tuned for all that and more here at KBOO Portland. But first, here's the Riverboat Sessions.
The Riverboat Sessions.
When we pull up in front of the farmhouse in Minnesota, none of us can quite believe we've made it. We've been pulling the Channel Princess Riverboat on a flatbed trailer across the Rockies and through the Midwest. We sit three across on the bench seat of the welding truck we purchased out in Oregon. It's been burning oil and blowing smoke, but somehow it never once broke down, even on the long pulls through Wyoming mountain passes. Now we're here, the family farm in Chaska. This is where my mom grew up, where my grandpa was born, and where for the next week we'll be fixing up the boat before putting it into the Minnesota River, a few miles away. When we pull in, we're greeted by my uncle Steve. He's been farming this land practically his whole life, and now he runs the place, mostly by himself. While Reed and Benson are pulling out tools and setting up a ladder, Steve shows me around the farm. It looks pretty much the same as when I came out here as a kid. Hundreds of acres of rolling farmland, the barn with the dairy cows, and the three big silos. Steve is the reason I play music now. When I used to come to the farm, I would always spend time with Steve up in the studio room of the farmhouse, playing around on his old synthesizers. When I was 12, he sent me one of his old keyboards in the mail, my first real instrument with programmable sounds and sequencing. I would spend hours messing with the knobs and trying to remember how Uncle Steve had worked it.
I used to go with this friend of mine to his girlfriend's house, and they had a piano, and when I was hanging around while they were watching TV or doing something else, I just sat there at the piano and just started playing. Really know a lot about music. I learned it on my own. I did study, you know, I learned my chords, what they were and all that stuff, but and started writing right from the beginning. I just, because I didn't really know a lot of songs, and I just felt the urge to write my own, and I kind of just kept going. And
what was the first electric instrument that you were playing on?
Well, it's over there. It's the EML, and that is about 1974. I had just gotten out of high school, and they gave all of us kids, I think it was $2,000, and they said, go do with it what you want. Go to college, you know, and that could get you quite a ways back in those days. But so I went and blew it on the synthesizer. And it was a great choice, because I just love the thing. It was so different, and there really wasn't a lot of synthesizers out back then. And these synths were more of an instructional. They were meant to be, you know, to teach people how synths work, all the patch bays and all the stuff on them. And yeah, you can patch out, you know, oscillator one, you can run it into oscillator two. The only thing about it wasn't very stable. It didn't stay in tune very good, but a lot of them didn't. Being out of tune slightly was their sound. I mean, they were fat. After I bought it, I went out to the factory where they were made, and it was like in a warehouse district, and he had just a small little place, and there was like two people putting them together, but he had this room where I went into. It was all black lights. It was really just one guy that was building these. Then he eventually, I think he got into more of a computer keyboard, and that flopped. It was like cards that you had to punch to program. And like back then, you know, if you just didn't hit it right, you went under. I'm probably the only one he ever sold one to, but.
Steve has been helping the three of us get the boat ready. He's an amazing woodworker, and the barn beside the Channel Princess is stocked high with ash and butternut, cut and milled here on the property. His specialty is inlay, but he helps us on the simpler projects we have to get the boat ready for the river. He drives the bobcat when we hoist the motor up onto the boat, and he's running back and forth to his shop constantly, milling wood for Reed's bunk above the wheelhouse. In between all this, he's keeping up the work on the farm.
When did you first start working for the farm? I mean, you were conscripted early.
Well, yeah, I grew up as soon as I could do something, you know, 10 years old. I was all my teens, and then I went to high school and I got out on the work program. You know, when I was a sophomore, I came home at 1 o'clock. I was done with school because I don't know how they could make it work, but they said, oh, you're needed at home to do work or chores or something, like on work release or something. Yeah, I didn't get a very good education, really. You know, when I got done with high school, then I couldn't wait to get out of here and I left. So I went to trade school, moved to Chaska.
Wait, we're in Chaska.
Yeah, I went to I moved to downtown Chaska. Which is a long ways away, yeah. I did it for about a year, and I was thinking, you know, what am I going to do now? I can't go home. I got a place to live, but I'm living with three other guys, and it's kind of crappy. And my dad shows up where I work and says, I want you to come back. And he pleaded with me to come back, and he said, I'm going to buy a farm, and I want you to take it over and live there, and so I did that. But I didn't have anything to start. I mean, I didn't have machinery. I had a few pieces of machinery. I'd worked until I was 40 and didn't have anything.
On Wednesday afternoon, I'm outside the barn, grinding the last of the old paint off the transom, when Steve and my mom drive by. They're headed to a town meeting, a hearing about land use in Carver County. Apart from the synthesizers and the woodworking and running the farm, Steve is constantly at war with the town and the developers, trying to protect the farm from encroaching suburban development.
I'm the fifth generation. In 1870, it was pretty much... they just grew a little wheat. I mean, it was all woods and a log cabin. You know, it was pretty primitive. They were just settling the land. That would be Wendell and Grimm, who was my great-great-grandfather. Yeah, I have to get up at 8 in the morning tomorrow and meet with a lawyer to sign a purchase agreement for some land over there.
What's happening with it?
They're going to sell 8 acres. For a data center. The way is that city government really has kind of forced us off the land. They built a road through the farm fields, and they assessed the farmers on each side to pay for it. We were about a half a mile from the road. We didn't even have access to this road, and they assessed us this huge assessment.
What was the final bill?
It was $618,000. Basically, what their thought is, we're going to scare this guy, his family. They got this huge assessment. The only way they can get out of it is to sell their land so we can develop. Their basic interest is to develop the land to get the tax base out of it to pay for the roads. Continue farming it and screw you guys, you know, it'll be farmland forever. And
my mom talked about when she went with you to the meeting, people talking about the farm just as if the property was meat.
Yeah,
and it was just kind of this commodity object that was to be split and divided and passed and equatable to other chunks of similar sizes.
It's a big, like, it is a big meat grinder. You just, you know, the money goes in and the houses come out, and you know, I'm in the position where I can't stop it. Just in those neighborhoods over there, I just go, wow, is this really happening? You know, the people have their people come in and mow their lawns. They have their garbage cans full of goods every that come and pick them up, and they're just living these really weird lifestyles.
I think a lot of people too associate places like this that are multi-generational and that have a lot of space and that have a lot of traditional practices as being kind of this idealized everything, like that's what the country's really made of, you know. That relationship between you and the row of pastel houses, that people are kind of like the idea of there being a farm there, even though they don't like the reality of it, actually, the, you know, smells and sounds and unknowns, and they also are actively participating in its demise.
You know, they're just, oh wow, we just love seeing the open land, and we like seeing you out there, and you're, you know, it makes us feel good, and you know, blah blah blah. But three of them came, the neighborhood came and just were complaining about, you know, ruin our view, and it's gonna, we don't like it, you know, it's gonna lower our value on our house, and it's, well, it's like a half a mile away, you can't even see it.
But it's, but that's them. I mean, that's like, there's houses because there's development because there's, you know, because the land is being turned that way. Yeah. I haven't seen it in this setting at all, but the same people who move in complain about themselves.
Yeah.
The fact that they're moving in.
And they ruin my view. I mean, gee, I look out my window over there and I see all these freaking houses. I go, God. It, you know, you just can't, if you put it all into perspective, going back, I mean, there, this was all Native Americans living here 150 years ago or more. Farmers came in and just totally screwed everything up for them.
One song I was thinking of putting on was the song Point of No Return.
Oh.
When did you write that one?
Yeah, maybe 20 years ago. Yeah.
Really? 20 years ago?
Yeah. The core of the song. I mean, just getting people getting removed I've experienced a lot worse since then. You know, that song really just was probably more of what was to come than what was happening. I have a love of the land. That's why I stuck it out. You know, I love the farming end of it. And I don't, you know, I love to put the crop in and grow things. And even though I'm on this big commercial scale now, with you know, growing corn and soybeans, and it's gonna change. It's gonna change. And that's what I'd really love to keep it going in the family.
The driveway to Steve's old farmhouse has no entrance. Just up and over the curb between clean new identical houses. The last time I visited, I walked around those neighborhoods, mostly empty, on land that my mom grew up on. The streets were all the same, and they ended in little cul-de-sacs. At the end of each road, there was a small obelisk monument, standing alone, apparently standard issue for a new development. It seemed to stand in anticipation of the important people and names that would come from these shuttered houses. The placard on every monument was empty.
The Riverboat Sessions is recorded and produced from the deck of the Channel Princess Riverboat on a trip down the Mississippi. You can see pictures and video from our sessions at riversignal.com, where you can hear our original radio story featuring the performers recorded in these sessions.